Now, were all pilots commissioned in the First World War?
Oh, no. Oh, no, we had quite a number of sergeant pilots. Oh, yes. That was the lowest rank sergeant pilot. Damn fine fellows they were, too.
Tell me something about this combat business.
We had a sergeant pilot who won the BC in our squadron.
What's his name?
Mottishead. Mottishead. I don't know whether it mentions him in his book.
What did he win it for, do you know?
He was mortally wounded and he got over the lines and saved his observer's life.
After you'd had a session of combat, were you disorientated? Did you find it difficult to find your own way back to the lines?
Oh, no.
No problem.
No. Oh, it was really exciting. You didn't have any particular worries. All you had to jolly well see is that you got out of there. You didn't get in the way of his bullets. And we did that in a very simple way. We could do it while flying straight in DC. Just side-slipping slightly. So by the time his bullet got to you, he would slip to the side. Always side-slipping.
But after the melee of a combat, how did you orientate yourself relative to your base aerodrome? Presumably much of this took place over the lines, did it? So
I never had a scrap over our side of the lines.
You didn't?
It was always over the lines, because the Germans very seldom came over, except on reconnaissance at a great height. Well, you could usually see. You could see the shell fire and the... we went very far over. 40 miles over the line was a long way in those days. But I suppose we didn't average more than 10 or 15 miles over the lines. It was all close to the lines.
At what height would most of these combats take place at, roughly?
It was 16,500, 15,000 feet.
Did you notice yourself consciously suffering from lack of oxygen at that height?
Oh, by Jove, that was the biggest problem. You see, these are Lewis machine guns, and we had the double drum carrying 97 rounds, not the narrow drum. And there was a leather strap around the top. Now, they were carried in racks around the observer's cockpit. But the pilot also had a couple of racks just down by his seat. And the first thing you did was to use those drums up first. And if you started scrapping, say, at 12,000 feet, and don't forget the first time, the observer signally wanted a drum. I put my hand down like that, gloves on nearly, couldn't lift the damn thing up. I thought some could it had stuck. And it suddenly dawned on me that it was due to the altitude. And I had to work the thing up like this, just get it over to him like that. And he dropped it. That's how you held height. And the other, and the most painful thing about height, we're all open cockpits, was coming down, and the blood pressure being forced to the ends of your fingertips and the ends of your toes. It was agony. You couldn't get agony. Then you wanted to jump out of the machine. You've got over it in a few minutes. But sometimes if it came down very quickly, it was terrible, that blood pressure.
It must have been terribly cold up there. What sort of clothing did you wear on early morning patrols in the winter?
Oh, we had, of course, these
a apart from the official sort of flying jackets and so on, did you wear everything that you possessed underneath, pajamas and all?
Oh, yeah, you put plenty of woolies on. Those are the boots we wore. Sheepskin lined boots, and then we had the... there's Archie Jenks and myself with his pup and his rolls.
At high altitudes, they were normally aspirated engines, not supercharged. Did you lose a great deal of power?
Yes, quite a lot.
What was the maximum height you could go up to?
Well, according to this, the highest I went was 18,000 feet. But it took a hell of a lot of time to get there. But you no sooner got up then, it was time to come down again.
Did you have methods of leaning the mixture out as you went to higher up so that you didn't get a rich mixture cut out?
No, nothing at all. Just had an ordinary throttle.
So, really, every trip that you took, you sort of stood a 50-50 chance of having some sort of engine trouble, did you? Would you put it as high as that, or was it a bit more reliable?
I'm just trying to think about that question.
Carburetor icing.
Remember what it was now.
The engineers that serviced your planes, I suppose you had a lot of confidence in them.
Wonderful fellows. I was never let down. This is in flying in France, of course. Never let down by a Rolls-Royce engine or the servicing of it. All my troubles were bullets. Pop off. Magneto shot. That sort of thing.
Did you ever get wounded?
Not officially, no. I got one bullet between my lips, made of a bit sore, and one in my toe, which we pulled out and put the hard in on, and that was the end of that.
You must have had a charmed life, then.
Thank God I did have a charmed life.
Did you feel that you were going to come through unscathed?
I think so. I think so. After a while, you know, you get a little bit used to it, if you understand what I mean.
Did you carry a mascot, or did anybody else carry mascots and have their own sort of pet feelings, you know what I mean?
I didn't carry a mascot myself, but I had a most amusing experience with a... I think it was Violet the Rain. She was the favourite of the squadron. Everybody went in the squadron, had to go and see Violet Lorraine at the Hippodrome or wherever she was when they were on leave. But she gave me a great big... She had a song, sort of a bunny thing. Can't remember what it was. And I took this thing back with me. And I had it bolted on the front of my plane. I came back and the CO was out on the airplane. He says, "What the have you got there?" I said, "Violet gave me that." He said, "Take that bloody thing off right away. The Germans will get to know you." So it only went over the lines once.
You were telling me earlier on about the reason why Trenchard sent you back to England. Can you repeat that? Because that was a fascinating anecdote.
Now, how he came, he used to come and see us and collect the boys round him without even telling the CO that he was on the aerodrome. Well, he got us round us one morning and he looks at me and he says, Satchel, you've been out here a long time. Oh, not very long, sir. Now come on, he says, what was it? I said, 7 months. He said, good God, home tomorrow. I gave an instruction that everybody's got to have a rest after 3 months. Well, that's awful. I wasn't allowed to argue. I was home next day.
Now, I've heard him referred to as Boom Trenchard because of his deep voice.
Oh, yes.
Did he have a deep voice?
Oh, terribly deep, yes. Terrific voice. He was a great man.
And you were telling me about Dowden and old Sarum. Can you repeat that?
Well, merely that when I was sent back to England, towards the end of September 17, I was sent by, I think we used to call it Bolo House, it was a Dasperl house or something like that, down to report to Dowding at Salisbury, which I dearly did. And he said, come and see me, I'll pick you up at 9 o'clock in the morning, and went out to this field near Old Salem, to the left, to the right of Old Salem. And we leant over a gate, and he said, start an aerodrome there, Satchel. I said, right, give him some planes and a hang. Oh, he said, I'll deal with all that, sure enough. About a week later, I was giving displays to the local people of Salisbury. We used to troop out there on Sunday afternoon. But that was flying BE2Es. There were pushers in there, tractors.
Now, your meteorological facilities must have been terribly primitive. Did you have any form of met beefing before you got airborne, or any form of
met? Oh, you
had
weather forecasts.
Were they accurate? Or?
Pretty good, yes. Because they're only forecasting for about 20 or 30 miles ahead. But if there were any doubt, off you went and found out, and if it wasn't any good, you came back. There's something I wanted went through my mind. Night flying was very interesting. What we did there was to, you knew where you were by the German searchlights and of course by the shell fire on the ground. But this is the two lines. The British, all along about half a mile apart, had posts up with a green light that reflected backwards. So you flew on past this shelf line and you looked right and you see the green light, you knew you were over your side of the line. That's all you knew, then you had to find your way to the air.
How did you pick out the aerodrome? Did they have any special lighting for you to recognise?
They only had special lighting when you fired a signal. You had to know your way. To find your way. And you had to fire a Verrey's light, which was known as the colour of the day. The colour was changed every midnight. Every noon. It'll be green, red, white, so on. And you had to know the colour of the day. And you came to near your aerodrome and fired this light. And then they lit up the petrol cans. We landed at night as follows. Those are three petrol cans. This is the direction of the wind. There was a mechanic standing there, and there, and there. And immediately you fired that right colour, you lit those petrol cans. And you came on and you came in, landed, and he doused them. There you were, left in the dark. Wonderful, wonderful arrangement. But that was the first night flying done. I think we were the first squadron in France to fly at night. Of course, we didn't do it for more than a month or two when the 100 Squadron came out. It was a fully trained night flying squadron, 100 and 101. And some very good work, too. They incidentally flew the FE-2B. That was the Beardmore engine, FE. Not the Ravelry, but the Beardmore. Of course, the Beardmore was a very reliable engine. So was the Ravelry.
When you got airborne as a squadron, did you take off in formation?
Not usually, no. You formed formation 200 or 300 feet up. Occasionally two of you took off together, but we went two. We didn't normally take off in formation.
Was it possible to get these things into a spin? And if it was, could you get out of a spin?
I don't think anybody's ever spun an FE-2D. Of course, Bristol fighters, yes, they're lovely, spun like tops, I mean, but of course, spinning was part of the game. I mean, you didn't spin unnecessarily in France because you never knew what condition your wings were. That's where. Occasionally, fellows made a mistake. They'd come back having shot down a Hun or two and start skylarking. Well, that's what happened to the first Bristol fighter we ever had. The chap's wings came off. He didn't realise that they'd been smashed by bullets.
What was the most dangerous part about flying out there? When did you sustain most of the casualties? On takeoff, on landing? Apart from being shot up, I mean, due to pilot error and mechanical error, what was the most dangerous aspect? You yourself, right?
I suppose takeoff, in case of an engine failure, I suppose, although we had such reliable engines in Rolls. But I never knew anybody hurt himself on takeoff or landing. I've known it with no engines.
As you know, probably not so much now, but one of the dangerous parts, of course, is when they're turning onto final approach. They try and turn too steeply and, you know, too much rudder, their speed drops off and they're in the spin. Did you lose a lot of the people?
No. Oh, I've never heard of an FE-2D spinning. A Bristol fighter, yes, but of course you could correct it fairly quickly.
When you look back on your war experiences, Mr. Satchel, do you look back with a certain amount of romantic nostalgia, or do you feel that it's something that you would rather forget, never wishing it had never taken place, or...?
Well, strangely enough, you don't think about the gruesome parts of it. You think about the funny parts of it. Like flying along through the naval wireless area and that sort of thing. Remember that? Just the same as you had happened yesterday.
Was that the funniest incident that ever happened to you?
Oh, I used to have to go down to Hendon occasionally to fetch a Henry Farman up to Sedgwick. Remember what that would be, about 150 miles. I used to take 3 days to do it because there were three very nice country mansions on the way, and I landed in the grounds and they put me up for the night. That was a great trick, that was. Always look out for a nice big country mansion when you're flying. I used to do all that sort of silly thing.
Did you ever run into airframe icing at all? Or didn't you get that high? Perhaps you didn't get up in bad enough conditions.
No, we didn't. No. I've been up in 60 odd degrees of frost. Very, very cold, of course, that winter was, winter of 1617. But we had no trouble with icing.
Could Could you tell if your aircraft was getting near the stall? Would it judder at all? Did it have any characteristics which would tell you your airspeed was getting dangerously low?
Oh, you'd start sinking like that.
That's all it would do.
That's all it would do, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, oh, you would feel that immediately.
That's great.
Well, you must come and see some of these things. Oh,